It is the privilege and joy of the Handmaids of the Precious Blood to bring to you a spiritual conference given by Father John A. Hardin, S.J. Father Hardin's conferences have proved to be of invaluable inspiration to priests, religious, and laity alike, particularly in these days of unrest and turmoil. Father Hardin is professor of systematic theology at the Jesuit School of Theology, Loyola University, Chicago. Father conducts a course in Catholic higher education at St. John's University in Jamaica, New York. He is a well-known author, lecturer, and consultant to various national religious and educational enterprises, and is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin is the author of the Catholic Catechism, a contemporary catechism written according to the norms established by the Holy See in the New General Catechetical Directory. In the following conference, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, Holy Communion and the Practice of Charity. Father Hardin.
It is common knowledge that the Holy Eucharist is the center not only of our faith, but of our spiritual life. What may not be so evident, however, is that the cardinal virtue of Christianity, the practice of charity, is intimately tied in with the sacrament of God's love. We know this from the fact that at the Last Supper, Christ did two things, and these two will be the object of our reflections in this conference. He first of all instituted the Blessed Sacrament. Then he gave us his mandate on the practice of charity. In order to appreciate the implications of this relationship, I think we might profitably first look at Christ's teaching on charity and ask ourselves what is distinctive about the love that Christ came to teach, indeed command, at the Last Supper, and then to see how the practice of this kind of charity is dependent on our receiving the graces which come to us only from the Eucharist. First, then, the words of Christ. My little children, I shall not be with you much longer. I give you a new commandment. Love one another just as I have loved you. You also must love one another. By this love you have for one another, everyone will know that you are my disciples. So far, the teaching of Christ, which we've heard many times, and which is the bedrock of our faith. Note the context of these words. They were first of all spoken on the occasion when Christ was instituting the Blessed Sacrament. They were also spoken before he gave the extensive discourse on the eternal love between himself and the Father in the union of the Holy Spirit. There are certain features of Christ's teaching which deserve attention. First of all, it is not a mere recommendation, but a commandment. Simply, love one another. Imperative mood. He said, and he meant, it was a new commandment. commandments. Our question is, what is new about this commandment? First of all, the mutuality. It is no longer just that we are to love our neighbor as we love ourselves, which is, after all, the love of a person who happens to enter our lives and whom, because he has somehow entered our lives, whatever the word neighbor means, whether he's living next door or happened to cross our path or the chance caller on the telephone or a relative, by whatever principle we call him neighbor, the Old Testament said we are to love our neighbor as ourselves. Here, however, there is mutuality. Love one another. It is therefore not a one-sided or unilateral practice of charity. Here we should say immediately is the beginning of the Christian community, where it's not merely that I love someone else, go out towards that person, but that I love the person and he in turn loves me. There is a reciprocity. So the first feature of this new commandment that Christ gave us is its mutuality, in that we are to love one another, love and be loved, not only active but passive. As the foundation of that kind of interrelationship, which is, as we know, the basis of communitarian existence in the Catholic Church. The second distinctive feature which makes it new is the norm or the standard which Christ tells us we are to follow in loving one another. In the Old Testament, there was already, as we know in Deuteronomy, a commandment, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. What is the norm or the standard in the Torah, the Old Covenant? The standard is each person's love for himself, which, as we know from now quite some experience, is a constant, enduring, and deeply endearing love that we have for ourselves. One of the marvels that I never stop wondering at is the fact that the one person about whom we know the most bad things, all about that person's secret sins, yet, wonder of wonders, we love that person the most. Now, this ethic of the old law, this loving our neighbor as we love ourselves, is admittedly a very high ethic. This world would be a very wonderful place to live in if everybody followed even that Old Testament norm. If we loved everyone who entered our lives as we love ourselves, wouldn't that be something? Nevertheless, this is not yet the commandment of Christ. When then he spoke of being a new commandment, he meant it. We speak of the New Testament or the New Covenant being new, and we sometimes wonder why it's new, maybe only for chronological reasons. like everything which follows whatever preceded it, is new with relationship to the old which it follows? No. The reason, the fundamental reason, from the church's tradition, why the New Testament is new is because of this new commandment of love. What is new about it? It is new both in that it implies the foundation of a community, because you couldn't possibly, have you ever thought of this? Suppose we operated only on the Old Testament commandment, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Will that be an adequate foundation for a community? Not really. Because it would not imply that I am to love indeed, but to expect to be loved in return. You could have 30 people in the community, 15 loving their neighbor as themselves. That's the other 15. But unless all in that group were equally commanded to love one another, the one anotherness, the togetherness, the loving and being loved, the essence of authentic friendship is love not only given, which is Old Testament morality, but love requited. Am I clear? Christ commanded that we love, but that we should also expect to be loved in return. And whatever else community life is not, it is not just loving people, it is expecting to be loved in return. And none of us took, or some still to take, our vows not to be loved. Whatever sacrifice we make when we enter the religious life, one sacrifice is not to be loved. So the reciprocity, the love given and the love requited, what theologically we call the love of friendship, is what Christ commanded. And then, of course, the norm that he gave us. As I have loved you, remember, this is God speaking. How did he love? The more accurate question is, whom did he love? Because the real problem with how we love is whom we are called upon to love. I don't know whether you know that even the most perverse human nature, as long as it is still sane, loves someone. Did you know that? Even besides itself. You know there's love among thieves? Oh, yes. So the real test of how Christ loved and loves us, which he gave us as the norm of how we are to love one another, is not some speculative question on the methodology of love. Oh no, very simple. It's whom did Christ love? He loved those who did not love him. And as St. Paul tells us, he loved and he loves those who offend him, and who, when they sin grievously, though they may deny the vocabulary, turn their backs on him and hate him. He therefore loved, this is now Christ, just the night before he died. He loved, and this is a constant historical present, as I like to put it. He loved those who did not love him. Those who were putting him to death in a matter of hours, they were going to take him captive. He loved those who were not loving him, and in spite of their lack of appreciation, their lack of gratitude, and he loved them enduringly till the end. This then is the kind of love that Christ bids us to practice. There are people, and whether we are in the world, in dealing with the people with whom we work, or for whom we labor, or priests and rectories, or religious and communities, we are going to meet people. Strangely, some meet more of this kind of people than others, but that too is part of the mystery of this virtue, whom we simply don't relate to, as the modern jargon goes. We respect them, we recognize their obvious gifts and excellence, but we just don't take to them. Is this normal? Quite. Is it to be expected? Yes. Indeed, if humanly speaking, we related to everybody, do you know what? Whatever else Christ would have said at the Last Supper, he wouldn't have said this. He presumed that that will take place in our lives what took place in his. There were people towards whom, naturally or humanly speaking, Christ as man had human sensitivities. He didn't enjoy not being loved. He was human. We all like to be loved. No secret. And indeed, if we find people loving us, showing kindness and gentleness and forbearance towards us, well, we find it hard even not to go out towards them. So much so that one great Jesuit ascetical writer, Father Meschler, whom I read in the novitiate, whom I remember as saying, with people who are warm towards us, we've got to hold our hearts with both our hands. That's what I call Teutonic poetry. To keep them from going out to such people, right? Spontaneous. But, and thank God for the opportunity, there are people, I repeat, in some people's lives there are more such, but even in the most, well, loving personalities, there are people who will enter their lives who are quite obviously not lovable. We then are to love them, not in spite of, but precisely because of their not loving us, or showing us those marks of gentility, affection, and kindness that we spontaneously desire. So much then for part one. Christ gave us the example and set down the principle. Notice. And what we are liable to forget is that Christ's example, as in this case, is a criterion. As so, even as he loved his enemies, so we are to love, and let's say it, ours. Communion and community. Given this exalted moral mandate, clearly, human nature cannot achieve, would not even have conceived, this kind of love. Consequently, we would expect the same Christ who laid down the norm to also give us the grace. So he does. Consequently, we say that the grace is not only from Christ in the sense in which all grace comes from Christ, but comes literally from him in our reception of the sacrament of his love, which I like to say is the sacrament of his love and the sacrament for his love. This is the special sacramental grace of the Holy Eucharist as communion. As you know, all the sacraments have, besides either conferring sanctifying grace, if it is absent, as in baptism or penance, or increasing sanctifying grace, as in confirmation, also confer a special sacramental grace. Each one has its distinctive, unique sacramental grace, which only that sacrament confers. What is the unique sacramental grace of the Eucharist? It is the increase of charity. Without Holy Communion, Christian charity would be not difficult, but impossible. Where you notice the adjective Christian in the phrase Christian charity is the charity which Christ taught, practiced, and commanded, the one we've just described. No wonder Holy Communion is called the sacrament of unity, or as I prefer, the sacrament of community. How so? Well, if it is the sacrament which is to unite us, clearly there must be something which divides us. So there is. Now you might say, where will he go now? Because there are so many things that divide us. But on further reflection, I trust you agree, not with me, but with the great teachers of the church, that what divides us, naturally speaking, are our natural personal differences. After all, the Erich Fromms are read And after all the dissertations on divine charity are consulted, you will have to admit, I think, that all the divisions arise from our differences. How are we different? How are we different? You name it, and we're different. First of all, we are persons. And the theological definition of a person is a distinct individual. So the moment you say that, the moment you say person, you say an individual who is so distinct that God Himself, when He created our human spirit, which He did at the moment of our conception, created a unique soul which no one else possesses. How's that? You see how God planned all of this from the moment of conception, that we'd have something to do in this practice of charity? And He sure knew what He was doing. We differ then as personalities, saying which includes everything. We differ in our tastes. I don't just mean in our dietary tastes, but in whatever tastes we've got, whether it's color or size or heat or cold, or what some people call fresh air.
Please turn over to side B.